Perspective with Jesse Zurawell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I'm your host for the hour, Jesse Zurawell. And I do have a guest scheduled for today, but he hasn't been able to connect yet. So I'm going to get into some of the news that's been making the headlines. And of course, Ukraine has been dominating the headlines, Russia, Ukraine, and there's so much going on. The information seems to be coming in by the second and changing by the second. And it's hard to parse truth from fiction, half truth from fiction, but there are ways we can do so. We can do so by taking in all sides of what's coming in and comparing that to the history of what has happened in Ukraine, especially the recent history, the past 8 years since the coup, the Western-backed, primarily US-backed coup that took place in Maidan in 2014. And it's important to start with what that coup was exactly, because a lot of people in the West, especially the people who are in the I Stand With Ukraine crowd, are still under the illusion that that coup was a democratic change of power in Ukraine, and it was anything but. There are now easily available leaked calls. You can hear one in particular between Victoria Nuland, who was in the State Department at that time and is currently in the State Department, and Jeffrey Pyatt, who was then the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. And you can listen to them openly, almost in a very cavalier manner, planning regime change in Ukraine. And they're talking about working with Nazi elements, funding these Nazi elements, supporting them, and keeping them in power as a way to destabilize Russia, as a way to threaten Russia, in addition to the insane, ever encroaching on Russia NATO presence. And these are, well, Victoria Nuland, these are some of the same people who are in power now and telling us to stand with Ukraine against Russia as Russia attempts to, in Putin's words, denazify and demilitarize Ukraine, because it is ostensibly a NATO state, one more NATO state, even though it's not officially a part of NATO, it might as well be. It's another NATO state right on the border of Russia. And it's a huge national security threat to Russia. We simply have to reverse the picture in whichever country we're in and think, well, if X was on our doorstep the way NATO is on Russia's doorstep, what would we do? And go from there. I've just been notified that my guest is connected, and I'm going to jump into it with him. My guest today is, once again, I'm happy to say, UK-based journalist and author and researcher, Ian Davis. Ian publishes frequently at his own website, in-this-together.com, as well as at the excellent news outlet ukcolumn.org. And Ian recently published a timely piece for another outlet he publishes with as well, unlimitedhangout.com. He recently published a piece there that could not be more timely and really provides a lens for a high resolution lens for looking at what's happening with regard to Russia and Ukraine beyond the nation state level, which is a trap, so to speak, that's very easy to fall into, to just look at this as two competing nation states when there's much more going on than that. As I've been saying in previous shows, what we're seeing now is essentially a continuation of the globalist predator class's COVID-19 project or agenda that hasn't gone away. It's just metastasized into a new form, a new iteration, if you will. So Ian's latest piece is titled Technocracy, the Operating System for the New International Rules-Based Order. And it starts this way. The International Rules-Based Order, IRBO, is under threat and global power is shifting. As East and West rekindle old enmities, we are led to believe that this struggle will determine the future of international relations and the direction of nation states. However, the global transformation is not led by national governments, but by a global network of stakeholders, and global technocracy is their goal. Ian, thank you very much for joining me today to discuss this piece and the wider context, if you will, of what we're seeing happening with regard to Russia and Ukraine.
Hi, Jesse. It's nice to be with you again. Sorry for the delay. I think that, you know, if we look at the media coverage, which has been hopeless, hasn't it? And I mean, both the media that we receive and also the media that's coming out of Russia as well. I think, you know, we need to kind of treat both of these imposters the same, really. If you listen to what seems to have emerged as a pro-Putin narrative, it's cast the Ukraine as a fascist state. And obviously, if you look at it from our perspective, you know, we're saying that our media and our political establishment is casting Putin as some kind of Hitler type figure. And neither of those positions are accurate, really. In my view. I think there are elements within the Ukraine that are that could be far, we might call them the far right, neo-Nazis, neo-fascists, and they have a disproportionate political and military influence on the government, and I think, you know, we can look and sort of say that, yeah, they're certainly backed by Western powers, which affords them that disproportionate representation. But if you look at Ukraine's electoral history, on the whole, it votes socialist or social democrat. So, you know, that I think politically that the far right in the Ukraine are something of a fringe movement politically, but due to the support that they have had and have continued to have from NATO aligned countries, they're able to exert an undue influence on Ukrainian politics as a whole. So when Putin was speaking about the denazification of Ukraine, there is some legitimacy to that. And you know, because I think back in 2016 or 2017, but Putin raised the point that, you know, in his opinion, given what was happening, the exchange of shelling and the continued war in the Donbass, that, you know, it was debatable whether the central Ukrainian government had control really over groups like the Azov battalions, or whether they were acting autonomously. But as you said in my article, obviously I wrote the article before the events of what's happened in Ukraine, but I think a key element of what we're seeing unfold now, we can find that within the joint statement that Putin and Xi Jinping gave on the 4th of February, where they attempted to redefine the global world order with from a more kind of Eurasian centric point of view, with placing themselves, China and Russia, very much at the heart of that new world order. And I think one of the interesting things that came out of their statement was their focus on international intergovernmental institutions like the UN, and their focus on what they were reframing as the international law-based order. And I think if we look at what's happening in the Ukraine at the moment, certainly the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic are within the law in terms of declare international law, in terms of declaring their independence. They have met the criteria that under international law that would enable them to do that. They've got an elected legislature. They've got a, you know, they've got a functioning government in both republics. So the international law would seem to be on the side of Putin and Russia. And I say Putin, I mean, Putin, in my opinion, is just another criminal thug in charge of a big gang who are, in this case, you know, Russia and its military. But so there's that element to it. So I think that's the from my perspective, I would say that is the context of what is happening at the moment in terms of the sort of immediate, what I guess we could call the traditional geopolitical view.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, what it looks like to me is that we've got the kind of the old kind of Western hegemony kind of international rules-based order vying for a seat at the table with this new emerging Eurasian-based, Russian and China-led international law-based order. But they're both promoting exactly the same thing. There's no difference between them.
I was going to ask you, aren't the international rules-based order and the international law-based order essentially the same concept?
Yeah, they're absolutely on board with the zero carbon sustainable development goals. They're pushing that very heavily, both sides. They're absolutely on board with everything that's happened during COVID. They're both pushing censorship and control of information, more so perhaps on the Russian side, because Russia have got a very sort of close relationship with the World Economic Forum in terms of their involvement in things like Cyber Polygon. It would seem that Putin has got quite a close relationship with Schwab. Although, you know, traditionally Russia have shied away from the Davos, or for a number of years, Russia were shied away from the Davos gathering. However, at the same time, there's the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, which is a partner of the World Economic Forum, which has been running in parallel, really. And there's a number of things that have happened prior to the current situation, which I think are noteworthy, particularly the economic relationship between China and Russia has been, well, I suppose we could say blossoming, but it seems to have been blossoming particularly quickly over the last couple of months or so. So the Chinese have agreed to buy Russian grain, which is a sea change in terms of their policy, which they did again in early February before this took off. Mm-hmm. Both China and Russia have got independent in terms of financial communication systems, which is what the SWIFT system is. Russia have got their own, and so have China. So potentially Russia and China could trade with each other. And in terms of the economic sanctions that have been placed on Russia, well, I mean, for one thing, some of those sanctions were put in place before Russia invaded. So if we can call it an invasion, and I think that's questionable.
Indeed.
There's a lot been going on which would seem to be pushing Russia and China closer together. I don't see that this military action at the same time, this military action. So I'm not suggesting for one moment that Russia are in partnership with NATO in this. However, the net effect of what is happening is that Europe are going to struggle, for, certainly economically. You know, the loss of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline gas supply is going to have a major economic impact on Europe. Europe are turning their attention towards militarization. We've just seen recently that the Germans have committed to $100 billion in expenditure on their defense, additional expenditure on their defense. So they're militarizing, which is something that they've been trying to do for a long time. The European Military Union is something that they've been pursuing for a long time. America suddenly, you know, has with NATO, which has struggled since the end of the Cold War to have any kind of relevance, really, suddenly is relevant again. And Russia and China are forming closer potentially military, and certainly economic and industrial relations. China are heavily invested in the Arctic Belt and Road project. Russia are opening up the Arctic. They're investing billions in new ports and a fleet of some nuclear-powered icebreakers and so forth to open up the northern trade routes, which will help them trade with Europe potentially if they can, you know, get around Nord Stream 2. The whole situation is looking like, to me, is looking like the creation of power blocks, which will be like a new form of Cold War, but a kind of balanced power block with a US, European, NATO-led alliance on one side, with a bigger role for European Union in the middle in terms of its own defense capabilities, in terms of European defense, and a Eurasian power block. Probably, you know, I mean, it's looking like if we may even be able to include a sort of go further south than that, if you think in terms of BRICS as well, with India being included in that kind of power structure as well.
Right.
So none of this really serves the people of Ukraine or us any benefit at all. However, we've already seen, I mean, if we think that COVID-19 was a boon for the big pharma, for pharmaceutical corporations, it's almost as if now it's the turn for the military industrial complex. We've already seen stocks, BAE system stocks have shot through the roof. The military industrial, you know, complex, there was a recent article by Reuters talking about the reconfiguration of, you know, investment towards the military industrial complex. You know, it's not good in terms of the impact that it's going to have on the rest of us, because we're going to ultimately pay for this. It's going to mean higher taxes. It's going to certainly mean higher energy costs, the impact on energy, which was already bad from the kind of breakdown of international trade during the COVID-19 pseudo pandemic. This is going to exacerbate that. And also, obviously, it provides fantastic narrative cover for those people that know that what they've already done is to bring the global economy, to pull it apart. And the reason that they've pulled it apart is because they want to rebuild it in a new model. And this, everything enables that to happen. And I see this as very much part of that process. Because if they manage populations through fear, which we know that they do, what causes more fear than war?
Right. And it's been horrifyingly amazing to see how within a week people, just like with the pseudo pandemic, have fallen in line with the I stand with Ukraine narrative. And it's almost to a person, the same people who are shouting that from the parapets, who were the ones freaking out about the pseudo pandemic, the pandemic that never was, and these same people who were screaming that everybody needs to be injected with experimental pharmaceuticals for the common good. And it's, I don't want to say almost as if, because I think it really is the case that those people, which is much of the world, were primed by the COVID-19 pseudo pandemic to immediately fall in line the way they have, behind unwavering and blind and ahistorical support for Ukraine against Russia. And it's, again, horrifying to see that sort of social engineering play out in real time.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're faced with the same problem that we've been faced with, you know, perhaps from people that are looking at this from a more, you know, I mean, I don't want this to sound arrogant in any way, but perhaps with a more nuanced view of what's going on globally. In order to do that, you really need to kind of step back from it and consider, you know, the wider historical perspective, the wider geopolitical perspective, economic perspective. You know, and most people, obviously, you know, unlike you and I, Jesse, you know, they don't spend a lot of time dwelling on this kind of stuff. So, you know, it's easy for them to fall into or to be led into the kind of tropes that are kind of spewed out in it at times like this. And, you know, people reliant upon, I mean, the mainstream media, I can't remember a conflict where the mainstream media has been both completely absent. I mean, there's been little to no kind of footage or reports coming directly out of Ukraine. All we've heard are statements. I mean, we've heard a lot of statements, but the situation on the ground, I don't know about you, I must admit, I haven't seen much today. But I don't know about you, but I mean, my picture in my own mind of what is actually happening in Ukraine, if I was reliant upon the Western mainstream media, I wouldn't have a clue. I would be living in this world of extremist nation states like Russia waging some sort of World War II type atrocity on a poor victim nation of Ukraine. And that would be about as far as my understanding would go. And similarly, if I, you know, if I lived in Russia, you know, I would be thinking that, you know, that my our great leader was waging a war against the great evil NATO. You know, so in both cases, neither population has got much chance of actually figuring out what's going on. And, you know, some of the things that have been reported, I mean, the use of video game footage, the repurposing of footage from the war in the Donbass that's 3-4 years old, that kind of stuff that the media, it's not good enough for the media to say, oh, well, you know, we get this from the wires and you know, we run with it because we get it from the wires. That's not good enough. I mean, that's just putting your hands up and saying we are a waste of space, which is pretty much what they are at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have to take a short break, but I do want to pick up on that when we come back. And I also want to talk about where technocracy fits in to all of this. So more with Ian Davis after the break.
Suck it up.
It's not a big deal.
Snap out of
it. Just get over it.
We've all heard it. But if you're experiencing extreme stress, it's not just in your head. It can affect your entire body because toxic stress can hurt us physically without us even knowing it. If you've lost a job, worry about your next meal, or have trouble making it through the day, if you're feeling the effects of stress, we can help. Text STRESS to 211-211 to find a solution.
When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for youth.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals into your body.
And nicotine, which can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media.
Many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping.
Because when you talk, they hear you.
Learn more at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
When a crisis hits, close to home and across the globe, nonprofits are on the front lines, ready to serve.
Keep coming.
The demand for charitable services has skyrocketed, and nonprofits are rising to meet the needs. Healing. Nurturing. Rescuing. Honoring. Protecting. Caring. Inspiring. The work of philanthropic organizations of all sizes, across all missions, has never been more important. And it's donors and volunteers like you who make all this possible. Thank you. Together, we change the world. The Nonprofit Alliance.
This is Jesse Zurawell and Perspective on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Perspective. I am your host for the rest of the hour, Jesse Zurawell, and I've been speaking once again with UK-based journalist, author, and researcher Ian Davis. Ian recently published an excellent piece at unlimitedhangout.com titled Technocracy, the operating system for the new international rules-based order. And as I said at the beginning of the show, it's excellent for many reasons, one of those being that it provides what I like to say is a high-resolution lens through which to view what's happening with Russia and Ukraine in a larger context, a context that goes beyond just nation-state conflict. And it's important that we look at what's happening in Russia with Russia and Ukraine and essentially everything else in that larger context, because there is a globalist technocratic elite that is determining the policies by and large that nation states are enacting and enforcing, and that lead to conflicts, if you will, like the one we see now between Russia and Ukraine. And that's not to say that they're a cabal that controls and orchestrates everything, but they are a cabal and they do control and orchestrate a lot. And they're very good at manipulating world events provisionally to their benefit. And we're certainly seeing that now. And before the break, Ian and I were talking about some of the propaganda, really the psychological warfare that the media, particularly in the West, has been waging with regard to Ukraine and keeping people in line with the I stand with Ukraine ideology, as it's essentially become at this point. And Ian, we were talking about some of the footage that's been shown. Some of it has been derived from video games. Some of it has been repurposed from years past. And it's a whole new level. It's not unfamiliar, but it seems to be a whole new level of psychological warfare, of propaganda. And I say that because there's really no effort, as you were saying, by these press entities to put people on the ground and report what's happening, either through the wires or through live visual reports. And that's something I've never experienced in my lifetime when it comes to international conflict. So I'm wondering if you see this as a paradigm shift of sorts.
Yeah, I mean, I think it looks like, I think it's almost like the world's first social media war, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's being fought on the battlefield of public opinion. I mean, I don't doubt that there has been, you know, don't get me wrong, I do, you know, I'm aware that there's certainly been military action in Ukraine.
Right.
My understanding of it, and obviously it's a very fluid and fastly, you know, rapidly evolving situation, but my understanding of it, from what I can gather, is that they have basically, Russia have pushed into the Donbass and seem to have gone as far as Kharkiv and maybe a bit west of Kharkiv, and they have struck military targets in the wider Ukraine, and that includes, you know, striking targets around Kiev and other parts of the Ukraine. But other than that, I'm not quite sure what the extent of this quote unquote invasion is. I mean, right. given that the war in the Donbass has been going on for now for more than 8 years, and you know, I mean, again, I mean, the Russians have a point about the Minsk agreements. I mean, both Minsk 1 and Minsk 2. I mean, the Ukrainian government more or less sort of said, well, no, we can't be bothered with that. You know, I mean, and, you know,
And Germany and France as well.
And Germany and France, yeah. I mean, there doesn't seem to have been a lot of goodwill on the part of the negotiators or the people that were brokering the deal to put any kind of real political will behind it. And Russia have got a very good point about NATO as well. I mean, you can go back to the 2008 NATO Bucharest summit, where I think it was clause 23 of that summit said, openly stated, that it was NATO's intention to welcome the Ukraine and Georgia into NATO.
Right.
You know, and then you have Zelensky saying things like, you know, threatening to he says, create Ukraine as a nuclear power.
Right, and, as the Munich Security Conference.
Yeah. And I mean, if you're looking at that from a Russian perspective, I mean, if you were looking at it from a US perspective, and I think something that I mentioned the other day in another interview was if Mexico, formed an allegiance with China and became part of, you know, China's sphere of influence, and agreed to put Chinese troops and Chinese weaponry and Chinese missiles on the US border, what would be the US's reaction to that?
Right.
Because
we can look at the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Well, exactly, the Cuban Missile Crisis. Exactly. No major power wants that kind of threat on its... I mean, you've already got Estonia and Latvia. They're already, you know, in NATO. So, and I think it was, when did Putin say that it was a red line? I think that was about 3 or 4 weeks ago, wasn't it, where Putin said, you know, the NATO expansion into Ukraine is a red line.
Right.
And I think the thing that people fail to appreciate perhaps about the situation from the Russian political perspective, although I don't think it is necessarily shared by the people in Russia, but from their political perspective, in terms of their oligarchical establishment, which is what they've got, this is an existential threat to them. This is life or death. I mean, if you look at the what happened to the on the Eastern Front during the Second World War, I mean, Russia's losses were when you've got 10, 15 million people dying, then that has an impact on a national psyche. Of course it does.
Absolutely.
So you can't expect, I mean, the whole preposterous grandstanding of NATO over the last, well, most acutely over the last 4 or 5 months, but even during that, this continual expansionism. And to accuse Russia of expansionism is, well, it's bonkers. I don't see any sign of Russian expansionism. I see plenty of signs of NATO expansionism. And I think part of that was, as I said earlier, was for them to try and stay relevant. You know, NATO have always gone on about how they're a defensive alliance, and yet continually, I mean, Russia declared... Russia recognized the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic. It recognized them. That's not the same as declaring one, which is the way it's been sold in the West. Equally, right. you know, the West, the UK and France and Germany and the US recognized Bosnia-Herzegovina and Herzegovina.
Mm-hmm.
And Kosovo, yeah. So, and look what happened there. Now that was international recognition for republics, and arguably in the case of the DPR and the LPR, they've got a stronger claim to be able to form an independent state than Bosnia-Herzegovina did. They didn't, when they declared an independent state, they didn't have a functioning government.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas both those republics do. So, you know, it's very difficult. But that being said, you know, what are those republics really? They're an extension of Russian influence. I mean, I'm not saying that Russia are the good guys, and I think that's the problem. We see, it's like we're forced into this kind of sort of bipolar view. You've got the goodies against the baddies, and you
right.
know, you're either on the side of the goodies or the side of the baddies.
Right, that's really why I wanted to have this conversation with you and talk about this piece, because it's easy. Even for people like us who are paying attention to this on a daily, hourly, minute by minute basis, I would say, to fall into that bipolarity. And if you're not aware whatsoever that there is a higher system operating beyond the nation state level, then it's inevitable that you're going to fall into that bipolarity. But that said, once you're aware that there are supranational controls happening, it's still very difficult to parse what exactly is going on. And my fundamental operating principle has been to stand only with the people, the regular people who are going to inevitably suffer from what's going on, be they Russian or Ukrainian, be they in Western Ukraine or be they in Donbass or Crimea. I think that's always what we have to keep in mind. That should always be our fundamental operating principle. But that doesn't mean at the same time that we fall into the Putin is completely evil and irrational and not making purposeful choices in directing what's happening with Russia, and that we not fall into the other side of it, that all of Western Ukraine is made up of fascists and Nazi celebrators and Nazi collaborators and Nazi entities. And that said, I want to talk about how technocracy factors into this, because that is really, you know, as the title of your piece says, it's an operating system, and it's the operating system of this higher supranational cabal, as I called it earlier, which I think is appropriate in a lot of cases. It's their operating system, and it's really the way that they want to structure the entire world if they can get their way. And I'm hoping that you can talk about that and where that fits into what we're seeing play out with Russia and Ukraine.
Yeah, well, I mean, both the Western order and the Eastern order are both offering a form of technocracy. They're both surging ahead with it. So technocracy began in the progressive era in the United States. It was very much centered around Columbia University. It was a guy called Howard Scott, and he met M. King Hubbert, who's probably better known for his peak oil theory. And they proposed something called Technocracy Inc. And they put forward a manifesto in 1932 or 1934 for what they called a North American technate. The idea of which was the North American subcontinent. The idea is that a technocracy is ruled, but is a system of government that is ruled by a technocratic elite. So these would be people such as engineers, scientists. So the adage of led by science is a absolute 100% technocracy soundbite. Led by science is the epitome of technocracy. But it's not just that. It's, you know, it's the intellectual class and engineers and so forth, and mathematicians and scientists and that kind of thing. So the idea,
it's another way of saying follow the science.
Yeah, another way of saying follow the science. Yeah,
if you're following, you're being led by it.
Yeah. So the idea was that it would be a society that was managed in terms of resource management. So it would be a society where every individual's use of resources would be monitored and controlled by a central authority of technocrats. There was an economist called Veblen, and he called that a Soviet of technicians. So it has got the kind of central planning, economic central planning element of what we might call traditional kind of Soviet or traditional communist or socialist economic central planning. However, it also has the capitalist free market, or not free market, but the capitalist idea that you can profit if you follow the rules set by the technocrats. So providing you follow the rules set by the technocrats, you can still prosper. So it's not the same as perhaps a stronger socialist or even communist ideology, and it's not the same as a free market form of capitalism. So this is a managed capitalist market. That's the idea of technocracy, based upon the allocation of resources at both the corporate and right down to the individual level. So initially, Scott and Hubbard suggested the use of a change to the monetary system, and the change to the monetary system that they suggested was the use of energy certificates. And mm-hmm. through this, people could buy goods and services with their energy certificates. Things would be priced in terms of their energy cost of production. And
sounds familiar.
And through that mechanism, you would be able to centrally gather all the data of what people were doing in real time and make decisions based upon energy allocation from a central authority. Now, in 1930s America, that was a crazy idea because it was technologically impossible. However, people like the Rockefellers saw that with technological innovation, it would one day be possible to run this system. And they set about supporting the technocracy movement. Not so much because there is actually a current technocracy movement, but I mean, they were supporting the idea of technocracy in general. Mm-hmm. Then we move on to the 1970s, where Between Two Ages, Technotronic Era by Zbigniew Brzezinski, he didn't use the word technocracy, but he nonetheless described what we could envisage a technate to be. So this was a society ruled by an elite who would make all the decisions in terms of resource management. So then following that, obviously Brzezinski went ahead and he formed the Trilateral Commission with the David Rockefeller. And they became very influential in the encouragement and fostering of a growth of what we can call a technate in China. And they did this through encouraging liberalization politically in the West of trade arrangements with China. Lots of things like the Clinton administration enabling the export of quote unquote sensitive technology to China. You could go back to the famous meeting of Nixon in China with Deng Xiaoping, but really that was preceded by a visit by Kissinger. And Kissinger was mm-hmm. a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, where he was also a board member of the Rockefeller Foundation Trust. So they got a close relationship. They encouraged the development of this system in China through foreign direct investment. So foreign direct investment is not just financial investment, it's also an exchange of expertise and often an exchange of technology. And what's that created in China, and the Chinese are quite open about this, they don't hide this, is a modern day technocracy. Mm-hmm. So that is centered very much around the social credit system. And the social credit system isn't ubiquitous in China. There are some regions it hasn't reached at all. But in the cities, it's pretty extensive in the cities, and it's covered up to about 80% of Chinese provinces have got some form of social credit. A lot of that is still done on bits of paper and things like that. But, in the cities, it isn't. In the cities, it's full-blown automated social credit system where citizens are rewarded or punished depending upon their behaviour. So if you say the right things and do the right things, you'll be okay. But if you question the state, or if you go against the state, or you protest, you lose social credit points. And if you lose social credit points, then you can't, things like accessing services and so forth, and even accessing goods are restricted to you. So what we are seeing globally, and both the Chinese and Russian side, and you know, places like India, everywhere, what we're seeing, and also in the West, in the UK and in the US, is a rollout, undoubtedly, of that system. So with the imminent arrival of central bank digital currency, and combining that with digital identity, that will enable a very effective social credit system on a global scale. Now, despite the conflict that's going on in the Ukraine at the moment, neither East nor West are offering anything different in that regard. It's all right. A matter of how much they can foist this, or how quickly they can foist this upon the global population. And, you know, I think we are seeing a power struggle. Personally, I think we're seeing a power struggle at the moment for primacy within that system. But the system that they are both proposing has already been agreed. That is sustainable development. I mean, a big part of the Chinese technocracy is what they call their corporate social credit system. Well, their corporate social credit system controls the activity of business in China and multinational corporations. So you would think that multinational corporations would be unwilling to engage in that. It wouldn't be in their interests. But the thing about it is that those multinational corporations that have got the resources to be government partners will do very, very well out of the arrangement. And that's why they are 100% on board with what's happening.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, we're out of time and have to leave it there. And there's so much more that we could go into and that I want to go into. And as I always say when I wrap up our conversations, I hope you'll come back so that we can continue this conversation, because as you said, it's ever changing, it's fluid, and we really need to look beyond the binary that's being presented to us by both corporate and a lot of independent media. So Ian Davis, thank you once again for joining me, and I look forward to speaking with you next time.
Thank you very much, Jesse. Thanks for having me, and I apologize for my late arrival.
No worries. It was a pleasure. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.